So this is a dot to dot. This is how to connect dots, I guess. The purpose of it, it's ages are from 6 up, so I guess everybody here qualifies. And unfortunately, things are not that simple. The inverse problems are inherent to not just seismology, but all other, at least, implicitly, that we are trying to figure out how the Earth works in its deep interior by essentially relatively few measurements that we can make on the surface. So these few measurements are dots, and we want to connect them. Unfortunately, we don't have numbers or arrows, so most of the time we essentially are faced with a situation where we have some separate dots and we are trying to reconstruct the image from this. And to stress the need to cooperate, I marked dots with different colors, and they represent geochemistry, geodynamics, mineral physics, and seismology. And you can see that even with all this, it would be difficult to predict how to connect them. It turns out that it's a picture of the tulip. What I did is actually I removed about half of the dots and also removed the arrows which tell you how to connect them. So in order to succeed, we essentially have to exchange a lot of information and also try to gather more data in order to increase the number of dots, which can make appearance of the picture more clear. In particular, I will talk about seismological data, but they obviously are interpreted then by all the other fields in some way, and seismologists don't necessarily help with having derived vastly different models. The striking thing about this particular picture, where a polar cross-section through the Earth is shown for 3 different models of different resolution, but based essentially on the same data set. Okay? And you get these very different things, even though nobody did anything obviously wrong, actually. The stress is on obviously. Now, in general, we have made quite a bit of progress. So, for example, over a decade from the time that this... Is there a pointer someplace? Oh, sort of analog pointer. From the model M84C, which is now about 20 years old, over the next decade, we have collected much more data. And as you can see, this picture on the bottom is sharper, but for the most part, for example, this is at 100 kilometers, the fast area over South America has become more clearly identified with the continent. There are some details, for example, like in the old Pacific, but the mid-ocean ridges are a little bit tighter. But basically, the picture has not changed. This is a relatively long wavelength picture. The upper ones that sort of had a resolving half wavelengths of about 2,500 kilometers. This is about 1,000 kilometers. But as you can see, the features, main features, have not really changed all that much. And that has to do with the spectrum of heterogeneity inside the Earth, which actually is not terribly helpful in discovering, defining very fine details. Now, this is what we would like to do. So be able to, for example, track all these plumes. This picture actually is sort of a mistake that somebody made, but then I saw this discarded picture. It's all artificial, but I thought that people would enjoy seeing how the Earth in high resolution might look like. So we would like to strive for this, but on the other hand, I think that the nature, mathematics, physics are a little bit against us in in trying to achieve this. So, linear inverse problem. Basically, we want to solve an equation. It's a matrix equation where there is a matrix A which has a dimension, the number of rows corresponds to the number of data, the number of columns to the number of unknown, and we, in general, trying to find a solution to this problem by minimizing the answer in terms of the least squares. So, in general, we need to regularize the problem. We usually want to, well, there are two problems. One is that we don't have enough data, or at least we have areas of the world where we don't have enough data. And therefore, if we try to solve this without imposing some additional conditions, the whole thing would blow up. We can, for example, do this by, in addition to minimizing this difference, we also want a model that will have a minimum norm, that will have minimum squared integrated gradient, or actually even Laplace. And you can have any combination of these two, and very often this is applied. The solution of this problem can be achieved in several ways. One is, I don't want to get into too much of the theory here, not write too many equations, but basically you can, let's see, is there sort of place on the board that I can write without, so this A times X equal to D, you can multiply in the terms of least squares, you multiply both sides of this equation by the transpose of A. This results on in a square matrix that has the same dimension as X. And then you multiply by the inverse of ATA. Let's see. And this becomes then X, because this product of these two matrices is a diagonal unit matrix, identity matrix. X is equal to A T A minus 1. ATD. So this is the nominal least square solution, but we may find out that this inverse does not exist or is very unstable, and this is where you apply these additional conditions, which will result in the fact that you can get an answer. Yes?
I was wondering, is there a reason you're choosing the two norm?
Yes, it does matter, and I will come back to this. Basically, using only this norm is bad because it punishes model in places where you have fewer data. So actually, you can come up with fairly rough model, and perhaps if you remember this picture where I had shown three different models, one of them essentially did not exist in a southern hemisphere, and the reason for it was that we have relatively few data for the southern hemisphere. So it would try, because it wants to have a minimum norm in the places where you have few data, you would try to the desire for the model to be close, as close to zero as possible, prevail on the other hand, where you have, yes, the guy. Oh, I see, maybe I'm misunderstood. Well, I mean, you can use one norm, which is computationally more difficult. However, it does treat better data which have larger errors. You are not as sensitive to the bad data as you are when you use L2 norm. But on the other hand, the least squares has number of advantages, and I guess if you assume that your errors are random and uncorrelated, then essentially this is a maximum likelihood solution and mathematically makes sense. I'm sorry, I guess I misunderstood the question, but thanks, Guy, for... So the next few examples are intended to show how inverse problems work. So here, this comes from the book by Robert Parker, Geophysical Inverse Problems. And this example repeats itself through the first three or so chapters of the book. These are magnetic anomaly measurements with respect to the ridge, axis of the ridge. And you have dots spaced 1 kilometer each. So they are discrete measurements. And you are going to try to retrieve what actually is the magnetization on the ocean floor. So that's the inverse problem. It's actually a linear inverse problem because the value of the measurement is proportional to the value of the model. So in that sense, it's a nice clean example. Now, this is what a rectangular perturbation magnetization would give you. If you remember the distribution of the data, it's very similar, except that the data had a little kink on the just coming off from the maximum values. Now, this is so-called, some people call it kernel, some people call it representer. Kernel, probably, if I talk about it, I sort of am more tend to use kernel more often. This essentially would be a response, or what you would see on the surface if your signal was sort of a delta function, just sort of had a one single magnet on the bottom of the ocean. Okay, and it's possible to design inverse problems such that your answer is some linear combination of these functions. And this is actually what Parker does, and with number of illustrations where different norms are imposed, you get an answer that looks like this, and this kink on the edge expresses itself as these additional spiky signals, and you can see that there is a lot of perturbation, sort of like Gibbs phenomenon, and different norms that are applied from the L2 norm that is trying to minimize the model, to minimize the roughness of the model, or minimize the Laplacian of the model, you can get slightly different answers. But this is more or less one example of the solution to this linear inverse problem. This is another example where these are kernels of the attenuation function. There are essentially observations of attenuation of normal modes from angular order number 21 through 38. This is function of radius, so this is surface of the Earth. As you can see, by more or less halfway to Kormantu boundary, these things vanish. So obviously, you could not, with these data, tell anything about attenuation in deep mantle. The other thing that you want to notice is that these kernels are very similar. One way that one can think about the least squares equation. I don't know whether people, if I write here from the other side of the room, can see anything. I'm not quite sure how to deal with this, but just to make things even, I will write on this side of the board. So then.
You can move the screen up and down.
Yeah, maybe we can move it up a little bit. Okay, well, I will try to write here. We can, this ATA matrix can be decomposed in terms of the eigenvalues S. I always get confused. Or is the other way around? Is T here, or you remember the guy? Okay. So these are eigenvectors of this symmetric positive definite matrix. And these are their eigenvalues. They can be arranged in terms of the decreasing size of the eigenvalue. So the largest eigenvalue is lambda 1 and so forth. And what you can do is you can reject smaller eigenvalues, and in this way you can make the problem stable. Also, you can call your largest eigenvalues to be associated with this new coordinate system to be the significant data. And by comparing fit to the model with the, or misfit to the model with observations, you can actually determine how many eigenvalues you have to use in order to obtain answer that satisfies the data within the error limits. So in this particular case, it turns out that this data set, which has 18 different measurements, is worth less than 2 significant eigenvalues. That is, if you use 1, you misfit the data, but if you use 2 of them, you actually fit better than the data require. So the reason here is that these are nearly parallel functions, particularly if you take ones that are adjacent to each other, and therefore when you project it into the principal coordinate system, you get answers that are very similar. So this is one way to think about it. It's one way, by rejecting certain number of eigenvalues, it's one way to obtain the stable inverse, because the inverse of ATA is very similar to this, is V, but here you have lambda minus 1 VT, T is here. And so basically you already have the eigenvectors, and all you have to do is to take inverse of the eigenvalue, and obviously here where the small eigenvalues, either inverse or reciprocal, becomes very large. So you can reject the small eigenvalues and obtain what would be called, sometimes there's several different expressions used to define what's called generalized inverse, can be stable. The unpleasant thing is that if you cut these eigenvalues abruptly, you are essentially cutting a function that looks something like this. This is lambda minus 1. And you are cutting it somewhere here where it actually has the largest value. So you can have some unpleasant ringing effects. So this is what you do essentially in order to obtain an answer. A typical seismic experiment, I guess we can lower it down, I won't be writing anything, is essentially seismic tomography, where this is for local things. You have a bunch of earthquakes or sources in general. You have also a number of receivers, and the crisscrossing of the paths allows you to retrieve the in this case, two-dimensional structure under this array of receivers and sensors. And obviously, the travel time between source and receiver will be affected by the two-dimensional structure. The important thing is that you have a good chance of getting the answer only in places where you have actually large number of crisscrossing paths, because this is what will allow you to localize the anomaly. Now, in a smooth medium, you essentially have an infinite number of unknowns, and you somehow have to project this infinity into something that can be handled in a computer. So therefore, you have to parameterize your problem. Will, for right now, limit ourselves only to two dimensions. So just some function of call latitude and longitude can be expressed in terms of some unknown coefficients, ci, and then another function, known function of theta and phi, which would be, can be, which is the basis function. And the parameterization can be either local, where, for example, you just divide surface into blocks, perhaps of approximately equal area, and your basis function is 1 if you are within that unit area and 0 otherwise. On the other hand, you can also use it in terms of the global functions, so that, for example, this function g theta phi is can be expressed by spherical harmonics, POM, cosine m phi. Those of you that don't deal often with spherical harmonics, they're essentially two-dimensional Fourier transform on a sphere. So the sphere has certain special properties, but you can think about it as two-dimensional Fourier transform. The advantage of this is that it's very compact in the space domain, and we essentially operate in a space domain. Our data are collected in a space domain. So, for example, the basis function for this projection, where there's some 1600 more or less 5x5 blocks at the with the 5x5 degree at the equator, and then they essentially have the same increment in latitude but different increments in longitude in order to preserve the area. So you have just one of these squares filled. On the other hand, if you use spherical harmonics, so for example, L14, M equal 10, you have something that looks like this, and it exists everywhere. So essentially, you have to, well, that's the global basis function. On the other hand, if for certain reasons you prefer to think in the wave number domain, then if you expand this in a wave number domain, you have some energy for all L's and M's. On the other hand, this represents just one number, the real part of spherical harmonic 1410. So there are these trade-offs. These are sort of two extreme cases of parametrization. Is that all clear? Or, there is certain preference for using local parametrization. Part of it is that if you think about something that's sensitive to measurements along the path, say between this square and this square, only those squares which will be intersected by, say, great circle line connecting source and receiver will be affected. So your A matrix may be 95 or even more percent empty, okay? And then that allows you for significant savings in time if you want to calculate its inverse, particularly using some iterative methods. And on the other hand, the matrix is always full for global functions. However, global functions have some very nice properties too, and for relatively small inverse problems, it's still probably quite reasonable to use global functions. The other advantage of local representation, however, is that because our coverage by sources and receivers is very uneven, you can actually use these regularizing parameters as a function of both latitude and longitude. So in a sense, it allows you a better control over your solution. You cannot do that with global expansion, not easily anyway. Yeah.
So are you implying that when you're using the global method that you could fill in for areas that don't have enough data and somewhere using the data?
Yes. Well, I mean, obviously where you have no data, your answer would not be particularly reliable, but you interpolate if you use one of these smoothing criteria rather than, for example, norm. Because if you use norm, then you would like your model to be zero where you don't have data. If you use, for example, smoothness criterion, it will try to connect smoothly between, fill in the hole between areas that you control, so you, for example, can have a constant value there rather than zero. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and essentially the spherical harmonics are basically good for addressing the problem of the long wavelength structure. There is another form of parametrization which has some of the nice properties of the spherical harmonic global representation, which you can differentiate many times. These are spherical splines. So at each of the knots in the map above, you have something that looks like this. It's one at the center and then changes as a cubic spline just as a function of the distance from the center. And it has nice properties. It's twice differentiable. So for problems where you need to differentiate your model, it's difficult to do it with squares, sort of the block parametrization. And at the same time, it still has the property that it's only local in a sense that the within one knot, this function is non-zero only within the 2 times distance between the knots. The additional problem with parametrization is that it depends what physical model of the medium you use. Most of the time we are dealing with isotropic medium in which velocities are the same in all directions. But there are reasons to think that actually significant parts of the Earth are anisotropic. And in this particular case, this is the so-called radio anisotropy, where the axis of symmetry is vertical. It's a hexagonal structure and is the same in horizontal directions. In this case, you have actually 5 elastic constants instead of 2 for isotropic case. So if the medium is really anisotropic and you use isotropic representation, you can essentially map some of the anisotropy in some artificial way into your model. So it's very important to think through how you are going. You're going to always get an answer, but it's very important to parameterize or define your physical model in a way that's consistent with the properties of the real Earth. Introduction of anisotropy, for example, means that kernels for shear waves of different types here will have kernels that depend both on SH and SV velocities, and these sensitivities are actually different. It's a SH wave that's horizontally polarized S wave, and as you can see, actually depends both on the SV velocity and SH velocity. Its SV is actually large at the surface, sensitivity to SV. It's very large, it goes to zero at the bottom. On the other hand, SH kernel is large at the bottom. This is SCS. SKS, which K means that in the middle the wave travels through the core, we'll talk more about it later, you essentially have sensitivity only to SV velocity. So you essentially double the number of unknown parameters if you, for example, want to consider shear velocity model that's is radially it's either isotropic or anisotropic, but anyway, it is anisotropic in some general sense. A very important diagnostic function is the spectrum of heterogeneity. So, and we define it as the power spectrum. So this is expansion in terms of spherical harmonics. And this G of L is the power spectrum of heterogeneity. The way that we define spherical harmonics or normalize them, this represents the total energy for a particular order L. And as you can see, there are some examples of how these functions can look like. And here is more examples of how spherical harmonics look like. Here we are using it as a diagnostic, for example, in continuous model. This is the angular degree. This is the power. And in here you, for example, see that you have lot of power degree 2 at the depth of 550 kilometers. It decreases as you go to the boundary between upper and lower mantle, and then becomes quite small in a lower mantle. Here we actually have a discontinuous model where there's this allowed is discontinuity at the core mantle at the 670 boundary. And here you see, for example, a very large difference in the level of the signal, where in the upper mantle you have this very large degree 2, in the lower mantle you go to a spectrum that's much more flat. This is now a different example where you essentially plot the power spectrum as a function of angular degree and depth, surfaces at the top, and you can see that the spectrum is very rich and large at low angular order numbers in the upper mantle. This is 670 discontinuity. And then again, you have a lot of signal in the lower mantle, and the middle is either white or pink, however you want to define it. Now, in terms of the data, we can use. Yeah.
Is the fact that the power is highest also at low angular degrees just mean that you lose the ability to detect it at higher degrees?
Well, it sort of turns out that it does decrease very rapidly, and it's going to be very difficult to get short wavelength structures within the Earth, and particularly at very deep inside the Earth. However, there is every reason to believe that this is a real thing. It's not an artifact that we are just simply dumping the. Oh, okay. That we are dumping somehow the high orders. I will actually come back to this, not necessarily in this context, but we think that actually this fact that the spectrum is dominated by very large wavelength features is real.
It's
kind of saying
that, at least for the surface, that the reason we know is that on land,
No, well, actually, degree 5 is large in the uppermost 200-300 kilometers. Actually, at the end of the transition zone, the dominating order is degree 2. So there is a change as you go through the upper mantle.
But my point is that if you look at a local earthquake market, the spectrum you get from that, or the right on the spectrum you get from both, so the shape of the spectrum is consistent between global studies and local studies. So we think that we know what the shape of the spectrum is. And it's very much like the spectrum of topography, if you go up.
So it's real.
It's real. I mean,
well, it's that you get that change when we have large steps at the top and the bottom, that doesn't risk. We're certainly going to put true at the top.
And also that in between it's light.
Yeah, so I mean if we just stayed on the left side of the diagram and went from the top to the bottom, I see that we probably got that resolution and that's real structure. The question is the fact that you're power's dying off as you go from left to right. Is this just the fact that you're losing resolution, or is this the statement that there's no fine scale heterogeneity?
Well, there is fine scale heterogeneity, but it's more, it's like topography. You know, you go to the Alps and say, wow, you know, but the real topography we get comes from Bunsen's notion. Right? So the whole spectrum is just falling off. And yeah,
I have some pictures later on, so maybe. Maybe I can go on and we'll catch up with this. But in general, yes, it's true that in terms of the power spectra, the spectrum, particularly at the low, both in the upper mantle and lowermost mantle, is really dominated by the very large scale structures. And that's we think it's real. Different kinds of data can be used. So, for example, if you use the whole seismogram, you have these rays that sample the mantle in different ways. So even if you take the path in this particular case, it's between Columbia and Palisades, New York, you don't have just one function, for example, P or S, but you sample the structure in very different ways. And so there is ways of using complete seismograms and invert their waveforms in order to obtain constraints on the structure. This in particular are body waves. There is diffracted S, double S reflection, triple, quadruple, and quintuple. And I guess the point is that spherically symmetric structure, you can see actually the difference between the arrivals. If you use only upper mantle model, you still see the misalignment of the observed and synthetic seismogram. On the other hand, if you use the whole mantle 3D structure, then you can fit all of these reasonably well. So this is an example of using waveforms, in this case, transverse component SH, for constraining the structure. There are some other, the important data are the differential travel times where you measure difference between the time that SS phase spends traveling between source and receiver and the S wave. And the advantage here is that the paths near source and receiver through the upper mantle are quite similar, so the large heterogeneity in the upper mantle does not disturb the result. You are really sensitive to the structure at the midpoint reflection, but also you are sensitive to the structure in the lower mantle. So in a sense, the differential travel times have some nice properties, but you can put the difference attributed either to S or SS or both. This is an example of a very long wavelengths. These are surface waves that travel around the Earth on multiple paths. You see that the difference between synthetic and data is large for the radially symmetric model, that this difference then vanishes when you use predict the perturbation by the 3D model. And again, these very long period waves can be used in terms of the waveforms as a data init version. This is looking at the previous picture a little bit more closely. In addition to these groups of fundamental modes, there are some other phases, so-called X phase, between the two. And as you can see, they also depend on the structure. For example, the differences that you see there for a spherically symmetric model go away when you use a 3D structure. And that provides you with additional constraints, not only on the upper mantle, but also on the lower mantle from the waveform inversion. You can also use splitting of more normal modes. This is something that Guy will talk later about, so I'm just going to skip it. But essentially, normal mode splitting is sensitive to the structure. This is essentially the structure or the local perturbation in frequency that you would obtain for this particular model. And this is the kernel. I forget which is which, but this actually is shear velocity kernel. This, I think, is the density kernel, and or maybe this is, and the other one is compressional velocity kernel. So in this case, you can see that this mode is mostly sensitive to the shear velocity in the lower mantle. Another mode is mostly sensitive to the p-velocity structure in the outer core, and it has also certain sensitivity to the inner core. And actually, this is one reason that we see that we cannot predict splitting of the model by the mantle structure is evidence for the anisotropy of the inner core. Now, this famous ATA matrix, let's see, which is it, this? What would I do? Okay, stop. The ATA matrix can be broken up into being built by obtained from different building different data sets. So it could be a data set, for example, consisting of, say, Rayleigh wave dispersion. This could be a data set attributed to S waves. So you can build your inner product matrix using different data sets. And this particular picture, and I didn't pay attention which is this one, and it's down. It's going to really go down. In this particular case, where the diagonal elements are large, the ATA matrix will correspond, the diagonal elements correspond to largest eigenvalues. And essentially, these are ATA matrices for different data sets. This corresponds to the top of the structure, the MOHO. This corresponds to the core mantle boundary. And you can see that the Love wave dispersion penetrates relatively shallowly. This is 670 kilometers. The same for the Rayleigh waves. They are not sensitive to the lower mantle structure. But as you keep adding different data sets, such as body wave waveforms, you are beginning to be very sensitive to the structure near a transition zone, and eventually with these waves to the lower mantle, in particular this SKKS minus SKS is sensitive only, or not only, but very strongly to the structure in the lowermost mantle. So by using different data sets, you essentially can achieve uniform sensitivity along the mantle radius. As you can see, for each separate data set, the sensitivity would be very uneven. For example, if you try to build a model based only on S waves, as some people have, you are sensitive to sort of middle mantle structure, but let me position myself under S, and to some extent the lower mantle structure, but not very much to the upper mantle. So to do this, you have to fill it up with other data. Now, these are different data sets. This is the data set. They are expanded in spherical harmonics, but individual measurements are shown by triangle. This is in seconds, depends on the color. And for example, the core reflections minus S have large patches which are not sampled. So for example, the S minus SKS data sets fill very nicely some of the gaps, such as here in the equatorial Pacific. And adding this data set can change significantly the answer. So this is an example of the resolution test. It's actually not usual checkerboard. It looks like checkerboard, but it's a spherical harmonic of a certain degree. And we want to see how well, not very high, it's sort of like L8, M6 or something like this. We want to see how well we can retrieve it, which is going to tell us how well we can hope to retrieve the structure. And here, the answer is relatively good for the northern hemisphere, or at least part of it, but things are beginning to fall apart south of Africa and in the eastern Pacific predominantly. But if you add this SKS minus S data set and SKKS minus AKS, you essentially improve the situation very dramatically. So now, maybe with exception of this region here, you actually have a fairly good resolution throughout. As a result, inclusion of this data set, with everything else being the same, leads to a much larger model of the structure just above 100 kilometers, more or less, above the core-mantle boundary. Generally, the pictures are similar. This is much stronger. The RMS is nearly about twice as large. And there are also some changes in the details of the structure. For example, in a part where the SCDS data set did not have many measurements.
I have a question.
Yes?
When you have a manifold data set, how do you weight the contribution?
Well, it's sort of an art to some extent. You can play games there. So these weights, you can sort of look, for example, you can establish some criteria, like for example, you want the largest diagonal element of the ATA matrix to be of the same size for all the matrices, okay, so that you more or less have an even resolution along the radius. Now, this is an example of this model which exists only in the upper hemisphere, and now I'm going to talk about some pitfalls and obviously this is not right. Perhaps it's right where there is a lot of data, but even there are differences with other models obtained using the same data set. These are power spectra of the three models. This is spherical harmonic degree up to degree 40. There is one model which was only degree 12 model, so its power goes to zero beyond degree 12. There is a model of Lapo-Boski, which essentially would be good to degree 14. That's the red model. And then there's Van der Hills model, which is this model that I showed on the previous slide, and it's power spectrum. As you can see, the all higher higher resolution model have a lower power than the degree 12 model where the MK model exists. Then there is a substantial difference, this is logarithmic scale, between, for example, model of Lapo and that on Van der Hills. At higher degrees, this is systematically higher. And of course, there is a question, which is better, which is more real? Actually, the answer to this is somewhat disturbing, as shown by this example. We actually make a synthetic test where we use a degree 12 model to shoot the data corresponding to the rays that actually for which we have measurements. And then we try to invert what model would come out from that. Okay? And so we use the input model, that's the power spectrum of the model, the degree 12 model. And then here we get the output model. And look what happened. This is not necessarily the optimal output model using this parameterization. It's probably over-damped in terms of norm. It has significantly smaller power than the input model by a factor of 3 or 4. On the other hand, it's has quite a bit of energy at orders that don't exist. So in a sense, we have artificially, by introducing the norm criterion, spread out the power towards higher degrees. So this, to some extent, answers your question that we really cannot, at least on a global scale, trust very much the results at higher order numbers. Well, this is now inversion using real data, and that's the answer. So in terms of using real data, you get even lower power at the low degrees and somewhat higher power at high degrees, which with some implication that there is some signal there, but it's not really that much higher than what essentially is a numerical noise. Now, this is an example of how, and this will be subject of the tutorial this afternoon, is using the same data set, in which in this case is just surface wave measurements, how you can affect the result by using different damping norms. So A has very low damping, B has somewhat higher damping, and C has even higher damping than B. And as you can see, there's very little difference at low degrees, but starting with degree about 10 or so, there begin to be enormous differences in the power spectrum of these two other models compared to this one. This clearly is underdamped. On the other hand, and these numbers are not shown, the difference in variance reduction is only about maybe 2% between A and B, and another 1% between B and C. So the very small difference in variance reduction can generate a very large signal to the model. So these are these small eigenvalues that you are trying to solve for. The more is not always the better. This is an example where, again, the phase velocity data at 75 seconds, Rayleigh waves at 75 seconds, this is inverted for just degree 16 spherical harmonics with no damping, because there is enough data to constrain everything stably up to degree 16. Here, on the other hand, we have a 2 by 2 degrees blocks, which there is about 10,000 of those. So here we have about 300 coefficients. Here we have about 10,000 coefficients. And actually, the answer using or searching for 10,000 coefficients gives us a worse result and introduces artifacts. I'm not saying that this is the optimal solution that one could get, but this illustrates the trade-offs that exist. So the model is both smaller and has certain artifacts which have to do with the ray coverage. You can see these things running through the Atlantic, which obviously is an artifact. Now, here we are coming to the point that was raised earlier. So these are spectra of certain different data sets. So this is the ocean function. And you can see it's flat up to degree about 6 or 5 anyway. And then it decreases at the rate of about L square or L to minus 2. So it's very rapid. You have the similar thing with the residuals of S function, you have actually similar thing also for free air gravity, and very similar thing for one of the models in this particular case. It's in OS deepest layer inside his structure. So the question is whether it's real and how it originates. And this is an example. What happens is where you do this truncation, what's the effect of this steeply descending part. So this is the flat part of the ocean function. As you can see, you pretty much pick up continents and you pick oceans, it's pretty smooth line. You essentially quintuple the number of coefficients that you use. Here you use up to spherical harmonic 32, but the shape remains roughly the same. You are beginning to pick up some details. For example, here New Zealand is beginning to emerge, also to some extent, I guess, Japanese islands. But and the contour line is a little bit rougher, but essentially you gained very little by introducing or extending this, or including the spectrum below this flat part of it. It's ocean function, which is crustal thickness for the continents and crustal thickness for the oceans. So it's expanded in spherical harmonics, and you can then, so this is something that's not, that we really know. The same thing works with free air gravity. So for example, here is the map of the free air gravity for degrees 2 and 8. It's really not 80 coefficients, but only 76, since degree 1 is not included. And you can see that there are these very large scale structures, for example, this ring that sort of more or less is around Pacific. Now you go to dramatically greater resolution, the degree up to 360, there is something like 130,000 coefficients used to build this, but actually if you compare it with previous map and the color scale is different, you actually see still these features that are very large wavelengths. So the structure where you have a flat part of the spectrum at low wave numbers and then steeply descending part essentially means that the however long you go along this steeply descending part, you are still going to pick up, and the dominating feature of the map will be these very long wavelengths coefficients. Here I try to see how it may have to do with for example, inclusion of the continent, so we approximate continent of Africa by 40 by 60 degree ellipse, where the values will be 1 and 0 outside, and in another experiment, Australia, which is about 40 by 20 degrees. And here are the power spectra. For the 40 by 60, you have the flat part, and then you have a part of the spectrum that actually goes like L to minus, well, 2 or 3 in this particular case, but it's very close to 2. The smaller structure is flat to larger order numbers, but then also begins to decrease like L to the minus 2. So this L minus 2 thing that we see in different geophysical functions actually is related to the fact that thing is dominating or dominated by very large wavelength anomalies. The small-scale anomalies exist, but they are buried in this very difficult to establish part, which goes down as L minus 2. Remember that for each order here, the number of coefficients that you have to evaluate is equal to 2L plus 1. So for this, for L equal 50, you have 101 coefficients. I guess I'm getting a little bit behind. So what we want to do is we want to run some examples, how actually what it is that we can trust and how different models are affected by things. So here we take an input model, which is a sort of existing degree 12 model. We shoot rays through it and we invert for some 25,000 blocks, and we essentially retrieve more or less the starting structure. So that's why it's called successful output. Then we use, well, that if the two look the same, you are able to retrieve the structure that you put in. No, it probably took some experimentation with different damping factors, because using different damping factors, you have unsuccessful output, which is overdamped, and as you can see, the energy of in this model gathers in some particular places where the rest of it is pretty flat. Now, here is plot of the path density. So this is number of hits that a voxel in the model encounters, and as you can see, this is logarithmic scale, so there are very large differences. And basically, where the model is large, where you have a lot of data. And it begins to look very much like models that were proposed by Van der Hilst and Grant. You essentially see these things where you have a lot of data and the model is very flat in places where you don't have data. So you have to be extremely careful interpretation of your answers, and a lot of experimentation with different damping factors is necessary in order to understand which are the stable and unstable parts of your model. Now, this is, we are beginning to, there is also one thing which is called the elephant experiment, where four blindfolded scientists were asked to describe an elephant. And without understanding what the size of the beast is, one looked at the leg, one looked at the trunk, the other one, the tail or whatever other part of anatomy of an elephant, and they came up with very different reports. This also has happened in seismology. For example, and I'm not going to say from which paper this is, but attempt was made to characterize the structure or the type of the structure, the level of heterogeneity in the lowermost mantle by studying the SCS arrivals in these three relatively small ellipses. Okay, and there were three, and they turned out rather similar results, so therefore the authors were sure that this characterizes the whole lower mantle. And then, of course, you can see that all of them happened to be in relatively fast areas, and they totally missed the most significant facts in the structure. So the very important thing is that you really, you either have to understand the nature of the heterogeneity in order to interpret your regional results in a certain context. So this is essentially a indication of a need for global studies, that in order to understand the system, you essentially have, at least at a certain level of wavelengths, have to know what the system is. So that's it.
Okay, thank you, Adam. Break.
We sort of be filling gaps, I guess, as we go along, and the next lecture they give, which will be about body waves, actually will probably define the menagerie of the different waves. Here the idea was that you introduce a new data set and you get significantly different answer.
Those presentation material will be online?
Yes.
Yes, that's the idea. We have to. figure out how to do it.
Well, basically, this is PowerPoint presentation, so it can be stored in its entirety.
The intention is to have all of the material.
Yeah, and those are reading list. Do you have those papers like distributed to us, or we have to print it out?
I didn't prepare a reading list. This result came from about 10 or 20 papers, so don't want to kill you with this. The idea at this point was to introduce a concept that just because something came out from somebody's computer doesn't necessarily mean it's right and you can rely on it. You essentially have to ask some very hard questions. What data have been used? Were they how the data sampled the medium, what type of dumping people have used, what results you can obtain if you use different dumping. And this actually you're going to play around with this afternoon. We can probably, at the tutorial, we'll recommend two papers for reading, which sort of probably bring up the most of what I have said. I will be updating it.
It'll get updated and maybe get some of the PDFs in there, but we'll have to do it.
What was the physical meaning of that power?
Well, the physical meaning is, this is sort of like the amplitude spectrum in a Fourier domain, okay? But it's a two-dimensional one. So it essentially tells you where the power in the model is. The trick here, which is, some people could do it differently, is that they could show you average power per harmonic of a particular degree. Here we show a total power at a particular degree. Okay, so this is characteristic of a certain wavelength. And we obviously remove, so this result is sort of invariant with rotation of your coordinate system. You still get the same answer. So that's essentially tells you where the energy in a spectrum is. So when you get large numbers, it's high energy, and if you get low numbers, it's low energy. So the only thing here people can show power spectra where it will be normalized differently would be, for example, divided by additional 2L plus 1 if you want to have power spectrum per individual harmonic. Okay, here this is for all amps in a particular degree of the spherical harmonic.
This is probably another big question again. When you actually want to identify the fine scale of the heterogeneities, would you actually is a better method to actually subtract out the larger wavelengths or some sort of normalization where you actually bring out
Well, we hope, essentially, you probably cannot do this just because of the way that the data exists. You cannot obtain higher resolution, much higher resolution than those shown in these examples here on a global scale. But then there are certain regions where you have many more data. For example, regions that have a lot of earthquakes or a lot of seismographic stations, and preferably both, you can achieve better resolution. And then the strategic approach would be, for example, to eliminate the long wavelength structure and then just look at the short wavelength structure for a particular region. It doesn't change in terms of the wave number, but in terms of the wavelength, it does change. We essentially in all this, so that, but even if you corrected for this, there will be still this effect that the lowermost mantle is quite rich in the long wavelengths energy.
How long a wavelength are we talking
about? Well, it's sort of degree from one, particularly say degree two. So degree two has a wavelength of 20,000 kilometers at the surface and about 10,000 kilometers at the core-mantle boundary. So still very large wavelengths.
Okay.
I think we probably, I don't know, we can have some additional discussion in the afternoon.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
We probably should go ahead with the...
We should have a